First of all, I always like to give acknowledgements, so I'd like to acknowledge my T-shirt. this T-shirt, the copy of it, it was given to me. It was first made in honour of one of my heroes, namely Carl Schindler, at his birthday a few years ago by his former students, including Gunnar and Andreas Kopp and Ulrich Becker and a few others. So I like this T-shirt so much that I said, oh, is it possible to get another one? You know, and so they sent me one. It's one of my treasured possessions. But it has a serious function because if ever you're really worried about whether we're going to solve the reconnection problem, the answer is on the back, where it says rapidly evolving collection of something. Yeah, so that's the real answer that you've been looking for. So I want to give you an overview of the MHD aspects of reconnection, what we know about it already. So a little bit about 2D, a little bit about 3D. Terry Forbes is going to cover solar flares, and I'll say a little bit about coronal heating as well. Just starting off very simply, of course, reconnection is a fundamental process in a plasma. We can easily do a cartoon of what's happening here, but how do we understand the physics? It changes the topology, it converts magnetic energy into other forms, it accelerates fast particles. These are fundamental processes in the universe that we want to try and understand. And of course it's very important in the magnetosphere, as we'll be finding out from Joachim Biern, both in the magnetosphere, both at the magnetopores where you get flux transfer events, and in the tail where substorms are initiated, and we'll hear much more about that later. In the corona, it plays a key role in solar flares, in coronal mass ejections, and in coronal heating, as well as, of course, being very important in the dynamo. You can't reverse the sun's magnetic field without reconnection taking place. So the induction equation that we're very familiar with tells us how the magnetic field changes in time due to advection of the magnetic field with the plasma and due to diffusion. And of course there are many other ways in which you can break the idealness, very many other non-ideal terms that we're going to hear about from Jim Drake later on. In most of the universe, the magnetic Reynolds number is enormous, and so that means that the magnetic field is frozen to the plasma, hangs on to most of its energy, and in places like the solar corona, the magnetic field is by far the largest source of energy. And so we want to know how the corona manages to release its energy and convert it into other forms. It does so in essentially singularities, as far as the global field is concerned, singularities in the gradient of the magnetic field, where therefore the electric current is extraordinarily large, and the resulting electric fields are very large too. So of course naturally that leads to heating, to particle acceleration, naturally, but what are the details, of course, is what we're at here. How can current sheets themselves form? Well, there are lots of different ways. One is the current sheet can be driven by motions from outside, for example, motions of the foot points of coronal magnetic fields lines in the solar surface, where the motions are dominating. They can move the foot points around, and that can then drive the formation of current sheets up in the corona. So that can occur at null points. It can also occur along separatrices, the special field lines that come away from null points, by shearing motions. It can also occur, of course, spontaneously, where a region of strong current can form by one of the several kinds of resistive instability in a sheared field. And it can also be, these current shape formation can also be driven by some kind of ideal instability, or by the onset of non-equilibrium. And this can occur, is thought to occur at the onset of a flare, where in some models at least, essentially you have the start of non-equilibrium or of an eruptive instability, and those motions themselves then drive the formation of a current sheet here in this cartoon, at the X point, which is sitting underneath a rising closed flux tube. And of course, if you lie on your side, maybe you get similar kinds of processes in the magneto tail, as Karl Schindler and Joachim Birn and colleagues have suggested. In many cases, we've shown then the existence or the formation of current sheets in two dimensions, where we can use complex variable theory, and our analytical techniques are well developed. But it's a lot harder to show these things in three dimensions. There are a few cases where they've been shown in three dimensions, but it's a lot harder. So let me start then with the 2D reconnection, very simply. In 2D, it can only take place at an X point, where the electric currents become very large and the resulting strong dissipation allows the field lines to break, to change their connectivity, in other words, for reconnection to occur. And the theory is very well developed. Historically, the Sweet-Parker mechanism was the fundamental mechanism. That was then developed in the 60s by Petschek. And then after that, several of us were involved in proposing other fast regimes. So let me just go through this very, very quickly, because it is quite instructive. In the Sweet-Parker mechanism, you have two regions of oppositely directed but uniform magnetic field, which are coming in towards one another. This is the Sweet-Parker mechanism, and completely occupying the whole boundary between those oppositely directed magnetic fields is a current sheet. And then you look at this in a steady state, so you assume the magnetic fields are coming into the current sheet at a speed Vi, and the plasma is then going out at a speed Vo, and you assume that the length of your current sheet, which is given, it's occupying, as I say, the whole of the boundary between the oppositely directed field, that length is twice big L, and the width of the current sheet is twice little L. So you essentially, Sweet-Parker's model is just an order of magnitude model. You first of all apply mass conservation for the mass coming in and going out of the sheet. That gives you the first relationship here. You assume there's a steady balance between advection and diffusion, that the magnetic field lines are being carried into the sheet, and that is the speed at which they're diffusing through the plasma. That gives you the input speed, Vi, as eta over L, the diffusion speed over the width, little l. And then you assume that pressure gradients and magnetic forces can accelerate the plasma along the sheet, and that gives you an exit velocity of the Alfvén speed. And so from those three order of magnitude relations, you can deduce the reconnection rate for this mechanism. The reconnection rate is the value of the input speed in units of the Alfvén speed, and that then turns out to be the well-known 1 over square root of the magnetic Reynolds number. The magnetic Reynolds number here being based on the Alfvén speed and on the length of the sheet. Now, what did Petschek do? Well, he assumed that the Sweet-Parker current sheet only occupies a small part of the boundary between the opposing flux. So it's very much smaller, just the central region here. And he assumed that in a steady state you had four slow-mode shock waves standing in the flow here, the plasma and the magnetic field coming through these shock waves, and it's at the slow shocks that most of the magnetic energy conversion takes place. So these shocks have the effect of accelerating the plasma outwards and also heating the plasma. So you create two hot, fast jets. And the characteristic, the speed of those jets and the temperature of those jets are slightly different from the Sweet Parker, the simple Sweet Parker results. So the reconnection speed, well, in Petchek's mechanism, you can reconnect at any speed you like, up to a maximum value. If you force the reconnection at one speed, you will get one value for the length of the Sweet Parker and one value for the angle of the field. And then as you force it more rapidly, what happens is that the central sheet gets smaller and smaller, and the angles between the shocks get larger and larger. And that continues until you reach a maximum value. And the maximum value is the one that's classically quoted, just essentially 1 over the log of the magnetic Reynolds number. Notice that we're measuring the reconnection rate here as the speed of the plasma at large distances. So it's the input speed here, VE we call it, the speed with which magnetic field is being carried in at large distances. And it's being measured in terms of the Alfvén speed there as well. And so this is typically 0.1 or 0.01, depending on the value of the magnetic Reynolds number. But then Terry Forbes and I decided to ask ourselves the question, what is the effect of boundary conditions on steady reconnection? This is the question that Hashina-san mentioned yesterday, basically. You were looking at non-steady reconnection, essentially. But we were looking at steady reconnection and asking ourselves the question, what is the effect of boundary conditions? And the answer, the lessons that we learned from this just very simple two-dimensional steady state analysis, resistive MHD, are as follows, that boundary conditions are crucial. They make all the difference. And so unfortunately, Jim, you can't study reconnection without worrying about boundary conditions. I know you'd like to numerically, but I think you have to worry about them, and they vary from one application to another. The second lesson we learnt, though, is that the local behaviour is universal. The behaviour near the null point where the reconnection is taking place is always, essentially always the same. So that's something you could hope to learn about in 3D. Essentially, it's a Sweet Parker layer. Locally, what's happening near the reconnection point is that you've got a Sweet Parker layer. And what Gunnar and David and I have been looking at, trying to ask, is what is the local behavior in a 3D reconnecting situation, both in the non-null case and at the null point. And what we're finding is that there's not one answer to that, there are several possibilities. So 3D is a little bit more complicated than 2D. The other lesson we learnt is that the global environment around this local region essentially depends on the boundary conditions. It depends on how it's being forced at large distances. And the reconnection rate, what is it in two dimensions? Well, essentially, it's the rate at which you drive it. In most situations, the reconnection rate is going to be determined by the rate at which you're driving it. If you, in the sun, if you move your foot points at a certain rate, as in Klaus's experiments, for example, then the reconnection will take place at that rate. What will happen is that the dimensions of the local diffusive region will just adjust themselves to whatever rate you're driving at. And the nature of the global configuration around that will just adjust themselves to your boundary conditions. And that's the number one lesson, I think. That's true up to a certain maximum rate. You know, there is a maximum rate at which you can force things. But in most applications, you're not reaching that maximum rate on the sun. The foot point motions are not as high as that maximum rate. But the maximum rate you're going to get depends on the boundary conditions. So what do I mean by that? Well, we answered this, Terry and I, in several ways. First of all, it depends on the boundary conditions on the magnetic field. And we looked at two cases over the years. One in which the configuration essentially was almost uniform. That's to say, the magnetic field lines are just slightly curved in the global region. In other words, you have a perturbation to an anti-parallel state, right? It's almost anti-parallel, but there's slight curvature in the field lines which makes it non-so. And that is the assumption that Petschik made when he did his analysis. Or you could have it being highly non-uniform, where the field lines are highly curved in the inflow region. You could have it, for example, where you've got a perturbation to an X point. You could assume you start off with an X point field, and then you start to reconnect and you have a little current sheet near the origin which perturbs the X point. So that's a very different basic state that you're looking at. Now, one of the big misconceptions that Biskamp had in his famous paper is that he was starting out with an X point field, right? And he didn't realize that Petschik was starting out with basically an anti-parallel field. And so, surprise, surprise, you don't get the same result as Petschik. So the boundary conditions on the magnetic field are very important. And Petschik is one particular case of the almost uniform situation. And it's been well established now that Petschik's mechanism can occur provided you enhance your resistivity in the diffusion region. If you've got a uniform resistivity everywhere, I think the jury is still out, to be honest, and I'll tell you why later. Most people think that when eta is uniform that the current sheet must necessarily spread and occupy a large part of the opposing region. It's not completely obvious to me that's the ultimate answer. And really what we've learned is that the experiments that have been done on these fast regimes agree with the basic theory that we've developed, provided you make sure that you're adopting the same boundary conditions in both. That's essentially the bottom line. But also, as well as the nature of the inflow boundary condition on the magnetic field being important, whether it's how curved it is, how curved the field lines, the nature of the inflow is also very important. In other words, do you have basically a converging flow in your inflow region, or do you have a diverging flow? And the results are very different in those two cases. Or how converging is it, or how diverging is it? In this case, you tend to get very small current sheets. In this case, you tend to get very long current sheets. This is not Sweet Parker. This is quite different from Sweet Parker because you haven't got a uniform region outside, right? You've got a very different kind of situation outside the central current sheet. And this we call the flux pileup regime. And what we discovered is that the reconnection rate for flux pileup actually scales in the same way as Sweet Parker. That doesn't mean to say it is Sweet Parker. It scales in the same way. But there's a factor outside which is very different from Sweet Parker. So this is the message I want to get over is that this is not Sweet Parker. It's very different. The scaling factor is different, and the nature of the surrounding behavior of the magnetic field and the flow are very different from Sweet Parker. So I think it's been misnamed Sweet Parker by many people. And of course, we're going to hear a lot from Jim about the collisionless models with, for example, the Hall effect, that seem to show that you can get fast reconnection at a rate of typically a tenth of the Alfvén speed. Now, I think the kind of questions that are still left in 2D, it's mostly understood, but what is the effect of these outflow boundary conditions? This is something we haven't looked at yet, actually. We started to try to, but we haven't succeeded yet. Previously, the analysis focused on the inflow boundary conditions, but on the outflow boundary, if you're looking in a box, and usually in numerical models, you have a finite region, so you must worry about boundary conditions. On the outflow boundary, you're free to impose one boundary condition, usually, because there's a fast mode MHD characteristic that's propagating information into the volume. And so you're free to say what information that is that's being propagating into the volume, and that's going to determine, obviously, it's going to affect what's happening inside. That really, that fast mode characteristic is reflecting the fact that whatever is downstream, a long way downstream of the reconnection site, is going to have some influence on what's happening there. In these steady state conditions, of course, we're assuming that the wave travel times essentially are small compared with the time that we're considering. Another question to me: I haven't really heard many people lately talk about tearing mode instability. I know this is part of history, but is really the nonlinear development of tearing fully understood? That's to say, do you know how tearing will develop as a function of all the different boundary conditions that are possible, as a function of all the different parameters that are possible? People talk about different modes, nonlinear development, but under what situation, I'm interested in, under what situation does tearing develop into fast reconnection? What do you need to get that? Is that fully understood? I don't know. It's a question. And I think, to me, I'm very interested in trying to understand how we link all the variety of different external regions that are possible to the variety of different collisionless diffusion regions that Jim is going to mention. How do we link the local microscopic behavior to the global MHD that we've come to understand up till now? I think that's an interesting project, because I don't think it's quite as I don't think Jem has given us the final answer to that, basically, you know. Now, 3D reconnection, when we turn to three dimensions, there are lots of new features that we don't find in 2D. Of course, the structure of the null is very different. The simplest null has field components x, y, and minus 2z, so that you can satisfy div b equals 0. And you find that there are two families of field lines through the null point. There's a spine field line, an isolated field line, and there's a fan surface, a whole surface of field lines. And if the spine's coming in, then the fan field lines are all going out, and vice versa. So essentially, it's like having two flux tubes approaching one another and then spreading out. This is the kind of geometry that we've got. But this isn't the only geometry for a null point. There are, more generally, you can actually do a Taylor series analysis about a null point and ask, you know, what kinds of null points are possible. Previously, I just said Bx is equal to x, By is equal to y, Bz is minus 2z, right? But you could say Bx is Ax plus By plus z, By is, you know, dx plus ey plus fz, and similarly for bz. So you've got nine parameters, right, the coefficients of x, y, z in those three components. You can, of course, reduce the number. And Thomas Neukirch was very clever in reducing the number essentially to 1, 2, 3, 4 parameters. by suitable scalings, rotations of axes, orientations of axes, there really are only four genuine parameters near a knob. But four is still quite a lot. What Thomas did was to, with Claire Parnell and a few others, is to try and understand how the structure of the knob changes as you vary these parameters. The two important parameters, though, are big J, which is the current along the spine. And if you increase the current along the spine, what that does is to make the feel lines in the fan twist and to twist up more and more as you increase that current. And the other important parameter is the current in the fan. And if you have a current in the fan plane, what that does is to change the angle between the fan and the spine. They're no longer at 90 degrees. Of course, these are very important because in reconnection, because if reconnection's taking place, we know that field can't be potential. You have to have currents near the null. So these are important locally near the null point. A second important factor, though, as soon as you look in 3D, is the question of the topology of the magnetic field. It can be very complex. In 2D, things are relatively simple. You just look for the X points and work out the separatrix curves, the separatrix field lines, and then they divide the plane up into topologically distinct regions, in the sense that, in this case, if I've got four sunspots on the surface of the sun, then in this region, all the field lines will come from that sunspot and end up at that sunspot. So you've got four topologically distinct regions in the plane. Then if you go into 3D and you put four sunspots on the surface of the sun, then what you find is that you get separatrix surfaces, which are here forming domes, which again separate the volume into topologically distinct regions, so that all the field lines below this big dome go from this sunspot to that sunspot. And in general, these separatrix surfaces, which themselves consist of field lines, will intersect in a curve. And that curve is a separator. It's a very special field line which actually joins one null point to another. Now, in 2D, reconnection at the X will then, of course, transfer flux from one 2D region to another. In 3D, reconnection at the separator will do the same thing, transfer flux from one region to another. And this is something that Dana's looked at in great detail, for example. If you have a very complex field, and magnetic fields on the sun are extraordinarily complex, how do you understand their structure? Do you just plot a few arbitrary field lines? Well, that's what people have done for years. For example, if you've just got two sources, one bigger than another, one positive, one negative, would you just plot a few arbitrary field lines? Well, that's not very satisfactory. I think a much better method is to work out what the skeleton of the field is. The skeleton essentially is the set of separatrix surfaces that are separating the different topological regions. So for two unbalanced sources, suppose you had one source there, a big source there and a little source there. So this is what it looks like. You've got some field lines which go from this big source to that small source, and you've got the leftover field lines start out from here and then go out to infinity. And those two sets of field lines are separated by a separatrix surface. So this is the skeleton of the setup. You just have a dome which is separating the two types of field lines, and you have a null point on a spine with a spine, and its fan is what gives you the dome. What you can do is start to look at three sources and ask how many topologies are there possible. It turns out there are eight different topologies possible when you've only got three sources. So it's quite complex. This is the simplest configuration that you can have with a separator. It's a nice little topology where you have one source here, another one there, and another one there. And there's one null here, which has a spine and its fan forms a dome. And you have another null point here, which has a spine and its fan forms a vertical surface of field lines. So these two separatrix surfaces, these two fans, intersect in the separator, which joins the one null point to another. So this is a rather elegant configuration. Quite complex, but the simplest complex configuration with a separator that we could think of. And looking down on the structure, say, with three sources, this is an example where you've got one source there, one here, and one here. You can have a separate, you can have this topology, you can have this topology, or you can have this topology. And as you move the sources around, you can then bifurcate from one topology to another. And so we try to understand those bifurcations, and this shows you a little movie of what happens as you move them around. And you get local bifurcations where you create or destroy null points here. Happens quite quickly there, and then there are two bifurcations very close together, actually, where you create two null points and then destroy them again. There and there. Did you see them? You shouldn't blink when you're watching this. It goes so quickly. But it's quite neat just to show how you bifurcate from one topology to another by means of these local bifurcations where you're creating or destroying the null points. And essentially what we've done is to repeat this with four sources and completely understood what happens with four sources. And then, of course, it gets much more complicated if you have more than four sources. So, but these act as really building blocks for more complex field. When you go to more sources, you get higher order behavior. You can get multiple separators, and you can get null points up in the corona as well as down in the photospheric plane. And more realistic models are being built by Dana and by Rona here on this topic. And in particular trying to see what happens when you've got realistic configurations in flaring regions, you know, what kinds of topological structures lead to flares and what kinds don't is an important question. Okay, a third difference with 2D is the whole question of reconnection. In 3D, reconnection can occur either at a null point or in the absence of a null point. I'm still not quite sure what you mean in the magnetosphere by anti-parallel and component merging. Is anti-parallel merging just reconnection at a null point, and is component merging reconnection in the absence of a null point? I don't know. Maybe you can explain to me sometime.
Well, maybe you can explain to me how the
well,
how
reconnection at a null point.
Separator and separatrix geometry works in the magnetosphere. That's I'd be interested.
Right, yeah. So maybe we should sit down and try and answer that sometime. I always think when you get two communities coming together, you know, nomenclature is always an important thing to try and understand. Is anti-parallel merging just the same as null point merging or not? It can't be, because
I don't think so. No.
It can't be, because if you take the field of the magnetosphere and then you add a uniform field, you're going to get two null points, basically, with a separator joining them, aren't you? Is that right?
Yeah, that was the first... That's where it's the magnetosphere community that saddled us with the terminology of A-type and B-type nulls, because they get
two null
points in the magnetosphere. One separator, four flux domains, and this was all worked out in the 60s and 70s
in
the magnetosphere.
Stan Cowley and so, yeah.
Well, I think the background of these two pictures is basically two-dimensional, and the reconnection side is probably not at the null points in the magnetosphere, but somewhere else.
So it's probably non-null reconnection in the magnetosphere.
Both of them are probably non-null reconnection, but you use a local 2D approximation. So in that sense, it's a distinction between separator reconnection and null line reconnection.
Although the magnetopause is a less less obvious case, in that you have the null points in the cusp regions, and certainly a lot of, you know, the anti-parallel reconnection does appear to be located close to the close
does
to
that
the cusp
only happen with
null points generally. So it's a little uncertain, this relationship, and certainly I'd be interested in trying to.
I think it's a very loose definition at the moment. You know, anti-parallel means the fields are basically anti-parallel in some sense, and component is they're not basically anti-parallel. In which sense that is, that's TBD. I mean, it's just the basic idea was that on the night side, reconnection was primarily anti-parallel in some sense, and on the day side, it was often also component reconnection, although there are some proponents that would argue that anti-parallel reconnection even there was more important. And I think that's still an open question. But there's no hard physical definition that I'm aware of, at least, that says anti-parallel reconnection is if the angle between the reconnecting magnetic fields is less than, okay, or something along those lines. There's nothing.
So is it a sensible physical difference then? Between
it's a distinction basically of the external field far away from the reconnection
rather than locally what's going on.
Just the shear across the current layer. That's all it is.
Yeah. But locally it's essentially non-null reconnection in both cases, is what you're saying.
Probably, yes.
Yes.
But there may be local structures that form local null points which may be distinct from the ones that you get when you just look at the global structure of the magnetosphere embedded in the solar wind magnetic field. You get these null points, but that may be maybe different null points.
Mm-hmm.
So that
okay. At any rate, in 3D, reconnection can in principle occur either at nulls or in the absence of nulls, and this is a distinction that Carl and Michael and the Bochum gang have developed very nicely in their classic paper. You going to say something, Carl?
Oh, well, yeah. It just reminds me of a discussion we had with Klaus just outside. You have to reconnect flux, a certain amount of flux.
Yes.
Isn't there a problem with the null point reconnection to get enough flux? Because the flux has to.
I think we'll come to that actually in Gunnar's stuff, won't we?
Okay. Yeah. The term of null point reconnection maybe is a bit misleading because you don't reconnect only at the null point.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
You can't reconnect through a point. It's actually a
in
finite
3D.
Region,
yeah.
Which is localized.
The question is what is the geometry of the diffusion region?
Yeah.
Kind of spherical thing around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Extended along some spine or separated.
Yes.
Now, what we assume at the moment is that it's localized a sphere or something similar around the null point.
But then you have a kind of flux problem, don't you?
No. No.
Okay, we'll
get back to this discussion, certainly. At any rate, at a null point, there seem to be three types of reconnection, either spine or fan or separator, depending on whether the current is concentrating along the spine or in the fan or along the separator.
And what's the difference there? Are you going to explain that?
When they occur, I mean, that's something you're going to hear a lot more about. Yeah. In spine reconnection, I mean, the initial analysis was just a very, very simple one where we just assumed we'd got kinematic, steady, ideal situation, and all we did was to impose a magnetic field XY minus 2Z and just solved E plus V cross B is zero and curl E is equal to zero and deduced what the velocity and the electric field were in that steady ideal state around in the vicinity of the null point. And so what we did first of all was to, of course curl E will imply that E is grad grad of a scalar, let's call it F, and then plugging back into E plus V cross B, you find that grad F has to be perpendicular to B. So you can solve that along characteristics, namely along the magnetic field lines, and find out what your F and therefore your electric field is everywhere in a volume from conditions on a boundary. And then you ultimately can deduce what the velocity of the field lines is. So what we did first was to impose a continuous flow on lateral boundaries across a fan, and then try to find out what the velocity and the electric field were everywhere in the whole volume. And what happened is that it tended to produce a singularity along the spine. On the other hand, if we did the same thing but imposed continuous flow across the spine, then we got a kind of flipping of the field lines, a rotational flipping of the field lines above and below the fan, and that tended to produce a singularity in the fan. So we call that fan reconnection. But this was a very simple analysis, and you'll hear from Gunnar and David how we've more recently gone on beyond that and put resistivity in the calculation and tried to understand what's happening in and near the diffusion region. So the aim is to try and resolve those singularities and deduce the properties of these different kinds of reconnection. Separator reconnection as well, Dana's talked about, where essentially this is a nice simple model where you have flux coming from this source and flux going to that source initially, and then they reconnect like that at the separator. And a numerical example of that Klaus showed us earlier. Now, in the absence of a null, you can first of all ask, well, what is a qualitative model? In other words, how can you generalize Sweet and Parker? And you can do that very simply by assuming you've got two tubes inclined at an angle theta, and you have a diffusion region of some shape in between the two of them, and ask, what are the dimensions of the diffusion region? Well, if they're forced together slowly in a kind of Sweet Parker way. And then, of course, what you'll find is that the local reconnection rate is the same as Sweet Parker, except that there's an extra factor of the square root of sine of a half theta in here. So that gives you a maximum rate when the two are anti-parallel, and will give you zero when they're parallel.
What's the L in R? Where's the... I mean, is the L just...
This is Sweet Parker philosophy. You're just assuming you've got... You know what the dimensions of the diffusion region are, right? Now that may be the whole.
I thought it spread, tended to spread.
You're just focusing on that diffusion region, right? In Sweet Parker mentality, you're just simply focusing on the diffusion region. You're forgetting everything else that's around about, and you're assuming you know what the dimensions of that diffusion region are. And numerical experiments on this kind of thing, though, Mark has done, and we find some new results. So this was what Mark was talking about yesterday, briefly. If you start off with two tubes perpendicular to one another, you impose initially a stagnation point flow, and you watch it go, man, and see what happens. And is this anything like what you expected? Well, it certainly wasn't like what I expected. And these were the isosurfaces of B squared. See, as they come together, and isosurfaces of B squared tell you something. But when Mark first showed me this, I said, "Well, can't we see a bit more closely what's happening by plotting the field lines?" And Mark said, "Oh no, how can we plot the field lines?" And he went away and worked very hard at it. It took him quite a while, of course, because you can plot the field lines at any one instant. That's easy enough. But the question is, how do you follow them from one frame to another? Right? And so essentially you have to tie them to particles in an ideal region and follow those particles. And he did that beautifully, and this was the result, in which What he's done here is just to plot the felines in one of those tubes, and the colour is going to show you the locations where the parallel electric field is strong. In other words, where reconnection is taking place. It's spreading out, first of all, because of the stagnation point flow. These two tubes spread out, and then they start to reconnect in several locations, and you get this braided structure, and eventually you end up with a twisted flux tube. You start with two tubes that are straight, untwisted, and you end up with a nice twisted flux tube. But there are several reconnection locations if you look for the colours. Starting out in the middle, but then at the sides you can see other locations. And that's really what produces the braiding, the fact that you're essentially getting tearing in this sheet, and so getting multiple reconnection locations. And that's very nice, especially to an Italian. Does that make you feel at home, Francesco, seeing the spaghetti?
Overcooked.
Overcooked, I'm sorry about this.
What causes that initial, well, it looks like an expansion that you're seeing of the
are you just moving the energy?
Well, essentially, you have a stagnation point flow, and so you start off with a tube, and then the stagnation point flow spreads out that tube and actually forms two sheets that come together. So you're really getting the reconnection not of two flux tubes here, but of two flux sheets. One of the things we would like to do is to, and Mark's already done this to some extent, but not fully analysed it, I think it's fair to say, is to set up a simulation in which those two flux tubes remain as flux tubes until they start to reconnect, rather than becoming flux sheets. So you have to have a slightly different flow, really, which doesn't spread them as much.
Is it helicity conserved from it?
That's a good question, isn't it? The final twist you notice in the felines is about pi.
And the initial helicity?
Well, that's a good question. The features of this are that the reconnection fragments, right? And Klaus has found that as well in many of his experiments, and that you're creating this twisting, and we get approximate conservation of magnetic helicity. Of course, you can't get exact conservation because,
it's difficult to define at least.
No. It's easy. I'll show you in a sec. So you must get some change of helicity because, in a sense, 3D reconnection. You can define as, a region where the helicity is changing slightly, right? There must be a small change in helicity, but that change is small compared with the initial helicity. So you've got approximate conservation of magnetic helicity. Now, essentially, in this state, you have mutual helicity, and you can work out that mutual helicity. It's just 1 times the square of the flux of each flux tube. And the final state just has no mutual helicity, but it has a self-helicity. And you can work that out as well. Equating the two gives you a twist of exactly pi. So that's the calculation you were thinking of, Carl. Yeah.
The deviation depends on the resistivity, right?
Yes, that's right. There will be a very slight... it would be slightly less than pi. But I don't know whether we've measured...
10 or 20%, depending on how high the resistivity is.
Yeah, do you find that that if the resistivity is higher, then the twist is less?
Yeah.
Basically, because of the helicity...
with the decays.
Yeah. It's what you expect, yeah?
Yeah, one remark concerning the simulation. Calculation of helicity in this case isn't easy. I have to say that it took me 2 days to understand it because it's periodic periodic system, and it's not trivial to define helicity in a periodic system.
Mm.
Because there can be some nasty things, in particular if it's 3D periodic.
Yeah. And we've had detailed discussions with Mitch about this, who kind of first... He wrote a paper a few years ago in which he said that if you've got a triply periodic system, you know, as you often have in simulations, then magnetic helicity is meaningless. You can't define it. But there are some ifs and buts. I mean, if you've got an isolated flux tube like that, then you're fairly safe in defining it, I think, is the ultimate... Is the ultimate, yeah. So anyway, that's an interesting point that, of course, doesn't arise in 2D. Also, the higher the magnetic Reynolds number that Mark chooses, the more reconnection locations you find, and the more braiding you get. So you would expect that if you went to, you know, realistic values of RM, you would get a lot of locations and a lot of braiding and a lot of complexity produced. And that actually might be important for particle acceleration as well. So anyway, these were the things that, some of the things that Mark told us yesterday he was going to do, try to keep them as tubes, add twist. There were two other things you mentioned yesterday.
Looking at the difference in angle.
Yes, difference in angle. That's... there was another. Yeah. But anyway, I mean, looking at rerunning this experiment in different cases, understanding it in more detail. Now, a fourth difference, though, is the nature of magnetic field line velocities. This is something that Gunnar and David have been wrestling with. If you, what do you mean by a magnetic field line velocity in a resistive medium? Well, it's a velocity that's going to satisfy this equation. E plus W cross B. If you've got E plus W cross B equals zero, then W is the velocity, or a velocity, of the magnetic field lines. So, outside a diffusion region, of course, where it's ideal, field line velocity W will be identical with the fluid velocity, at least the normal components to the magnetic fields. Now, in 2D, inside the diffusion region, a field line velocity exists everywhere except at the X point, where it becomes singular. So you can imagine a magnetic field line coming in and then part of it entering a diffusion region, and the velocity of that field line is still very well defined, right? Because it's part of the field line outside the diffusion region, so you can identify the field line from one frame to another. And you can work out what... And the velocity of that field line is well defined in the diffusion region. You only get a problem at the X point, where it becomes singular, and that is, of course, where the reconnection takes place, just at one point in 2D. And... let's see, does this... There was a little movie that David had produced with this. There we go. And this is showing us the classic picture of reconnection of two flux tubes. So that's what we're used to. That's reconnection as we're used to it. And the two flux tubes come in, they reconnect, they rejoin perfectly. You end up with two flux tubes going out. Now, Gunnar and David and I sat down and tried to say, well, this is our basic understanding in 2D. Does that also work in 3D? And it turns out that in general, a field line velocity, a unique field line velocity, does not exist in 3D. If you have an isolated diffusion region, even though you can follow the ideal parts of the flux tubes of the field lines, because you can identify them from one time to another, inside the diffusion region, a field line velocity does not exist. In other words, there's no solution to that equation in general.
Eric, is it in the entire volume or only in a cut 3D?
Well, let's show you what we mean by that. What happens is that the field lines are, as Carl realized with you a while ago, is that the field lines are not changing their connections at one point. They're continually changing their connections as they pass through the diffusion region. You can sketch the field lines at any one time, right? But the question is, how do you identify field lines from one frame to another? And these field lines are continually changing their connections as they go through the diffusion region. That concept is completely different from what we've got in 2D. It's a completely different concept. So you can have, suppose you've got this field line in the ideal region, you follow it from there to there to there, and you draw this field line, and you draw the field line, and you find that this end of the field line is not moving at the plasma velocity. So what's really happening, of course, is that if you drew a field line from this point, it would be continually changing its connection to this field line inside the diffusion region. That's really what's happening. And that's very different from 2D. And what we also find is that the flux tubes, as they come in, they tend to split and they flip. And in general, after the reconnection's over, they don't rejoin perfectly. So this is a local example that David and Gunnar produced. You can see the field lines coming in. They're flipping. Well, they're splitting first of all, then they're flipping, and then they're moving out. And welcome, Mitch. Mitch has just arrived. We've been talking about magnetic helicity, you'll be glad to hear. Realizing how important it is in reconnection. So this is an example where actually the configuration is 2D at large distances, and locally it's 3D near the null point. And so you can see that this process of reconnection is very different from what we've got used to thinking about in 2D. That picture of what's happening is very, very different. And this is another example in which two tubes are coming in. In this case, it's a fully 3D example, and you end up not with two tubes at the end, you end up with four tubes. So that's to say, let's imagine you take a cut across that. You start off with these two tubes coming in. They come into the diffusion region, they reconnect, and what you end up with is four tubes, two tubes intersecting like this, and two other tubes intersecting like this. So these two tubes, in a sense, don't rejoin perfectly. And this kind of understanding that we're developing is purely as a basis of looking at the induction equation alone. We haven't put in any other physics. And that's one of the things we want to try and do over the next 4 weeks, try and think how we put in more physics into it, because we're just simply looking at the induction equation, working out what the consequences of the induction equation are. So the kinds of 3D questions one has are topology, what's the nature of complex, very complex coronal fields, spine separator, fan reconnection, also non-null reconnection. Can we produce models of these processes? So can we answer the question, what's the shape, what are the dimensions of the diffusion regions? We don't know yet. We know in 2D, but in 3D, what are the shapes of the diffusion regions and their sizes for these models? How fast can reconnection go? We don't know the answer to that either. So our understanding is extremely primitive at the moment. We've got a lot to do. Non-null reconnection as well. And the basic features, such as the nature of the field line velocities, are something that we've been wrestling with. I think what I'll do is skip on to the end, actually. I think I'll, since time's getting on, I'll miss out the bit on coronal heating, which essentially is an application of reconnection, because we're really much more interested in the fundamentals of reconnection, and just go to my conclusions then. You can look at what I've said about coronal heating there at your leisure, as they say in American, and it's also on the web as well. So the conclusions I would have is that in 2D, there are many regimes. They depend on the nature of the inflow, on the boundary conditions in a steady state. In 3D, we can either have reconnection with or without nulls. Several regimes are possible. You can get fragmentation, a new feature, and also the role of twist and the role of braiding and the role of conservation of magnetic helicity is very important. The concept of a single field line velocity is being replaced, actually. What we've done is to replace it by a concept of a double field line velocity. That's to say, what we can do is imagine we're just looking at the field line from one side, and we can work out what its field line velocity is, and we can work out what the field line velocity of the field line coming from the other side is. So in order to describe what's going on, we need two field line velocities, not one, at any point inside the diffusion region. Field lines continually change their directions in the diffusion region. They split, they flip, they don't rejoin perfectly. And reconnection on the sun, of course, crucial in flares, as we'll hear from Terry, and coronal heating. But there are extra questions that had occurred to me as well. What's the threshold for reconnection? What is it that determines when reconnection occurs? Does it occur equally at null points or without null points? If you have a complex configuration, this is related both to the flare question and to the magnetospheric question, what determines where the reconnection occurs in practice? I think that's something we've really got to try and grapple with over the next 4 weeks. What determines where non-null reconnection can occur? What's the rate and partition of energy? The role of microscopic processes? How does it accelerate particles? Well, Jim's going to give the answer to those last questions, hopefully. But thank you very much. Why don't we... what should we do? Should we just carry on straight away with your talk, or should we just have a five-minute... breather. Let's have a breather for literally 5 minutes, shall we, and come back. Is that reasonable?
Sure.
Yeah.